This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Welcome to our Friday night lecture, which is also the beginning of our theme weekend. And so it's good to see some new faces and some regular faces. I'm excited about this weekend and about this book. I love the book of Ecclesiastes. That's what we're here to look into. And yeah, what are we going to do with this strange and wonderful book? So tonight is the first of three lectures on the three biggest themes of Ecclesiastes, if you're familiar with it. And those themes being vapor, joy, and the fear of God. And my first thought, and maybe your first thought too, is that these things just don't belong together. And yet, in these pages, they're all together, side by side. And that's part of the gift of this book. So that we find in here, what we find in Ecclesiastes is an engagement with the tragic and the joyful in the fear of God, all at the same time. That's what's going on. So this book, it's full of surprises, and so be ready maybe to hear something new under the sun, contra the assembler. And let's bring on the first slide, which is just the title and the titles to come. So tonight is Everything is Vapor, A Table in the Mist is Tomorrow Morning, that's on joy, and A Different Kind of Fear, that will be tomorrow afternoon on the fear of God. So when I was a teenager, I lived what you could call a wild life. I got into trouble a lot, at home, at school, sometimes even with the law. And this had, maybe as you can imagine, some exhilarating highs. That was partly why I did it. And some of its existential lows. And some of those lows became more and more common for me. And I remember coming home and just feeling that kind of empty feeling in your gut, if you've had that feeling. And it was a night, I think it was after a party and maybe some drinks. And I remember looking over and seeing this Good News Bible sitting there that my grandmother had given me. And I just felt compelled to open it. I wasn't one to read the Bible in those days, but I felt compelled to do that. And I opened it up. And what did I read? Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And I looked, and I was like, is this the Bible? And I kept reading and reading and thinking, is this the Bible? And yes. And there was something in it, though, in these words that resonated with me, kind of beckoned me. And that became my entry point, really, into the world of the Bible. And eventually to coming back to God and to living as a Christian. And since then, I've come to understand that I'm not the only one who this has happened to. I have heard story after story of people having something very similar happen, that their first book into the Bible was this book, this interesting, strange book called Ecclesiastes. And it seems that there's just something about this book that just calls out to people, that beckons them, whether they're cynics or optimists, whether they're agnostics or fundamentalists, or whether they're loving life or hating life. There's something about this book that draws a variety of people into the scriptures, but into itself. And my guess is that most of you have maybe felt something of that. If you've come here tonight, you've felt that in Ecclesiastes, you've been drawn by it, And if not, maybe by the end, you will. That's my hope. So tonight I'm going to spend about a little more than half of our time just introducing you to the book and to the assembler, otherwise known as the teacher or the preacher. And then in the second half, I'm going to talk about vapor. Everything is vapor, the first theme. Of course, I'll be touching on that even as I do these introductions. And then tomorrow, the next two themes. So I've been reading Ecclesiastes on and off since my teenage years. For now, it's going to be about 30 years. And
not that old.
Yes, I am. Thank you. Yeah, brownie point. And these three themes, they're the big themes of Ecclesiastes, but they've also been big themes in my life. So this is quite personal for me, too, in many ways. But for the last 3 or 4 years, I've really given this book my attention. I've really looked at every word. I've read dozens of books, commentaries, translations, and there's always more to read. I keep hearing about, Joshua keeps telling me about new books I have to buy. And the end of Ecclesiastes says there's no end to the writing of many books, and there's no end to the writing of books on Ecclesiastes. There must be hundreds, maybe thousands, I don't know. The few books in the Western world have received as much attention as this book. I didn't know that before. But it's received a ton of attention through history from especially poets have loved this book, philosophers, theologians, philosophers, agnostics, fundamentalists, everybody, really. So much so that its language is part of our language. So here's just a list of few of the expressions that come from this book. Of course, there's nothing new under the sun. People come and go. You can't take it with you. There's a time for everything. There's nothing better. That's your lot. There's a fly in the ointment. A little bird told me.
Oh, my mother got that. How did you know
that? A little bird. That's right. But yeah, people are engaging with Ecclesiastes really on a daily basis. And they don't even have to read the Bible. It's out there. It's in our midst. Few books have had this influence, and few books have given rise to such contradictory interpretations. If you read the history of interpretation, it is an interesting history, to say the least. Especially regarding this main character, Kohelet, in Hebrew, otherwise known as the teacher or the preacher. That's how it's mostly translated. But the word means one who gathers, one who assembles. And that's what this character is doing all the way through. This assembler has gathered wisdom. It says he's gone and he's listened to Proverbs and straightened them out. And then he's gathered them and assembled them in this book, in these words. And then in chapter 2, he assembles buildings and all kinds of constructions. And then he assembles strange themes together we don't think should belong together, the themes we're looking at. And then at the end it says he taught the people. So then he assembles the people and teaches them knowledge, it says. So he's the assembler. And that's why I choose that word. And people either love the assembler or they hate him. Or they're just plain confused by him. And usually that's how you start. And there's pessimistic takes. There's optimistic takes. There's this guy must be a backslidden Jew. No, this guy's a God-fearing Jew. You know, this guy's mentally insane. No, this guy is one of the most sane amongst us. And how is it that this one who elicits such contradictory responses has had such a lasting influence and continues to captivate us? I think this description by Elizabeth Stone says it really well. I've said this before here. Like a candle flame in the mist, we cannot see him or touch him or name him, and yet he is there. And as surely as food gives a fragrance and drums resound, Kohelet gives us his own particular light. Kohelet, elusive and fantastic and quixotic though he may be, has entrenched himself firmly in our life and background, and we may challenge his right to sit there, but he goes right on sitting. So good. Except for maybe quixotic, even though I love that word, which means an impractical idealist. By the end, I hope you see he's more than that, and that he's neither a pessimist nor an optimist, but something much better. There's a history to these contrasting views that's really important to look at. One of the significant ones is Saint Jerome. So he lived from 347 to 420. He translated the Bible into Latin. He also wrote a commentary on Ecclesiastes. From what I remember, he didn't take a lot of time. I think it was about 2 days. He wrote a commentary, which is not enough time for Ecclesiastes. But anyways, his take, because he wrote a commentary, became the dominant take for a long time. And his take was primarily a negative one on the assembler, which gave rise to a variety of expressions. So, well, yes, this guy must be a backslidden believer. This guy is an agnostic who resorts to meaningless hedonism to get by. Or this guy shows us what life without God is like until you get to the end. I think those are very common views that you run into. But I think if you really read this book, you realize the assembler is not without God. He's running into God at every turn, if you're paying attention. And he sees him giving us good gifts in the midst of this troublesome life that we live, this world that's upside down. And he doesn't exemplify meaningless hedonism. Rather, he exemplifies a joy from God, he keeps telling us about, that we're to receive from him and to live before him in holy fear. So, maybe be ready for a different take than you've heard in the past. I've looked at every Hebrew word in this book. I've looked at a lot of really good translations and commentaries. Robert Alter's being one of the best, if you want a translation. And I haven't been fully satisfied with any one of them. I've really loved this bit and this one and that bit and that one and what this commentary says here. So my goal has been to bring all the best bits together into one translation. So I've been working on that for some time, and at least in my opinion, the best bits. And that's what I've done. I've pretty much finished it. I'm just checking with some Old Testament scholars to make sure I'm lexically, grammatically grounded and contextually grounded in what I'm saying. And it's been really one of the most difficult. It's one of the most difficult books in the Bible to translate, I found out midway, but also one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done. There's nothing better than translating Ecclesiastes. Except maybe living it. So I'm going to be sharing a lot of this with you.
I say, ouch.
So, let's start. This is the very beginning. This is chapter 1, the first part of chapter 1. The words of the assembler, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Utter vapor, says the assembler. Utter vapor. Everything is vapor. What remains for people from all their toil at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes, another comes, and the earth remains fixed forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down. Then to its home, there, panting, it rises. Going south, then turning north, turning, turning goes the wind, and whirling overhead, the wind returns. All streams go to the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they go again. All the things are tired. No one is able to speak. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, and the ear is not filled with hearing. What is will come again, and what was done will be done again, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, look, something new? It was already here for ages before us. There is no memory of the past, and none for what comes next. There will be no memory of either with those after us. So, what are these words doing in the Bible? Aren't they a little too depressing, maybe? Too dark to be in Scripture? I think that question has been around actually for a long time because of what appears to be contradictions in the Bible. Contradictions with what's in Ecclesiastes and the rest of the Bible. Contradictions within the book. And then all the contradictory interpretations that have come out of the book. And so Michael Fox has highlighted this feature in his seminal book, Qohelet and His Contradictions. So what are we supposed to do with these conflicting words of the assembler? This book, along with books like Proverbs, the Song of Songs, Job, they belong to what's called the wisdom literature of the Bible. But what kind of wisdom is this? What kind of peculiar light is shining in these pages? And I would want to say it is a wisdom of contradictions. But I would want to add one really important word, apparent. That it's the assembler and his apparent contradictions, which is another way of saying paradox. So a paradox is something that on the surface, it appears to be self-contradictory, right? But if you dig a little deeper, you listen a little longer, you realize, oh, this was actually true, these things. So for example, you could imagine a scientist giving a talk on the nature of light. And she starts and she says, light is made up of particles. And then a little later she says, light is made up of waves. And if you're listening and you stop there, you're like, oh wait, she just contradicted herself. She said it's this and this. It can only be one or the other. But if you keep listening, you realize, oh, light is actually both particles and waves. That's what physics tells us. And I think if you're listening, that is what scientists and artists, poets, comedians are all doing to us. They're trying to share with us the paradoxes of life, the incongruencies that they have seen and discovered and want you to share and be in awe of and laugh at times. And I think that's what the assembler is doing for us as well. So I think with Ecclesiastes, many people get a surface reading or they encounter one of the themes and then they start making their conclusions, but they don't read long enough, carefully enough. So consider this weekend as a digging deeper into paradox and to consider, could the assembler be one of the wise? Could his contradictory words be upright and true? Might they even come from the one good shepherd, God himself? So I consider myself one of those who take this as scripture. So in a sense, yes, ultimately, I believe this is from God. And people who believe in inspiration of scripture believe that these are God-breathed words. That they're from human beings and yet inspired by God. And so therefore they're authoritative for life and faith. I, though, personally also count myself amongst a new wave of scholars and popular writers who mostly are conservative, but who have taken a more positive interpretation of the assembler than is normally the case. And that's not a new thing necessarily totally. So people like Martin Luther had a very positive take on the assembler. But now that's just becoming more and more the case as you read more and more of the books coming out on Ecclesiastes. So scholars like Ian Provin, Craig Bartholomew, Bruce Waltke, John Walton, to name a few of the scholars. Two popular books that are out right now I would highly recommend if you want a book to just have a beginning access into Ecclesiastes. This one, Living Life Backwards. Has anyone seen this book before? By David Gibson. And this is one of my favorites, A Table in the Mist. This is where I got my title for the next lecture, by Jeffrey Myers. And this is another good one too, that there's so many books. Jacques Ellul, if you know Jacques Ellul, this book is one of my favorites on Ecclesiastes.
What's the name of it?
Reason for Being. It's originally written in French, of course, so that's an English translation. It's not so easy to get. But actually, my new favorite book, it's no end, right? Is this one by Uni Lee. I had never heard of her before until just about a month ago. And her book is called The Vitality of Enjoyment in Kohelet's Theological Rhetoric. That's a mouthful. But she did her PhD on Ecclesiastes. This book comes out of that under Chun Liang Su, who is also at the forefront of this new wave of scholarship. And she taught at Princeton for about 10 years. Now she's at Azusa in California. But this book is so good. I got it a few weeks ago, and about every page I was running to Anna with a new quote, new thing to share with her. So I'm going to share some of that with you tonight. But if you want scholarly details on what I'm talking about tonight, this is the book to go to. And it's her conviction that the assembler is this sage who confronts the reality of human existence with both its tragic and joyous dimensions and calls his audience to respond faithfully to the mysterious activity of God by living life to the full. That's what she says over and over again in this book, and very convincingly. And basically, that's what I'm going to be trying to share with you this weekend. So, I also want to say I count myself among the family of faith. And so not just with those who would agree with me and my take, or with this new wave of scholarship. So, for example, Tremper Longman, who I respect highly. I think I agree with everything I've read from him up to this point, except his take on Ecclesiastes. He's got a negative spin on, or a take on, the assembler. But that's okay, because we're first and foremost brothers and sisters in Christ before we agree on how we interpret the Bible. And so I want to affirm that and say that, and so that we should also be humble and generous towards each other. We only see in part. So let's be generous in that, and try to be corrected where we can be corrected and share what we have seen. So that's what I'm trying to do tonight. But what I do find fascinating about this book is that it can do the same work on a variety of different people with a variety of different takes and a variety of different translations. And that eventually it leads people to God. It does that same work on very different people with very different understandings of this book. Eventually it does that, which I think speaks to it being more than just a human book. And to some degree, we all start from the same place. And that place would be the wilderness. This book, Ecclesiastes, this is the book the Jews read on the Sabbath during the Feast of Booths. The Feast of Booths being the celebration that Jews practice when it's to remember their time in the wilderness, when they were between Egypt and the Promised Land, when they had to live in these tiny little shelters and God provided for them in miraculous ways. And so while they're in these booths, this is when they read the book of Ecclesiastes, which is in the wilderness. And the wilderness is, it's important to remember, it's between where God makes the promises to them at Mount Sinai and the Promised Land. All right, so that's where, what's the wilderness? They have to go through the wilderness before they get to the Promised Land. And what is the wilderness compared to the Promised Land? It's the opposite. of the Promised Land. So the Promised Land is a type of Eden. It's described as a land flowing with milk and honey. And what's the wilderness? It's dry and destitute. The opposite. So this is an important principle in Scripture and in life, and also something of a paradox, that many times before we inherit a promise, we have to endure and experience the opposite of the promise. There's a time for everything. That's why Hebrews says in 6:12, it's through faith and patience that we inherit the promises. We forget that last part, and we miss out on a lot of the promises because we think it should be instant, like everything else in our age. You can think of Joseph. He gets these dreams. He's going to rule over all these people. What happens first? The opposite, right? He becomes a slave and then a prisoner. He's ruled over by other people. So before the Promised Land, there's the wilderness. Before the resurrection, there's a cross. And before the promises of Proverbs are fulfilled, you got to endure the realities of Ecclesiastes. So I don't think Ecclesiastes contradicts Proverbs, or maybe necessarily claims that Proverbs promises too much. I think Ecclesiastes is dealing with the time when the promises haven't been fulfilled yet. So if you're familiar with the already not yet of Scripture, Proverbs is more about the already, when things are right side up, the way they should be, on the whole. There's exceptions, too, in Proverbs you got to pay attention to. And Ecclesiastes is about the not yet, for the most part. When everything's upside down, and not as it should be. Because the assembler has the conviction that something good is still coming. He hasn't given up on that. So he says here, Ecclesiastes 3:17, I said, I to my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. Because there is a time for every pleasure and concerning every work. And again, it's important to understand judgment isn't just about condemnation and punishment. The bigger category of judgment in the Scripture is about God setting things to right. Doing what's necessary to fulfill his promises and his purposes and to make things as they should be. That's the bigger category of judgment in the Scriptures. So it's not always some negative thing. Actually, it's never a negative thing. It's the appropriate thing God does. But the assembler sees this judgment coming in the future. Again, 8:12-13. When those who miss the mark do evil 100-fold, and there is length to them, nevertheless, I also know that good will come to those who fear God, who fear before his face. The good will not come to the wicked, and they will not lengthen days as a shadow when they do not fear before the face of God. So, God will judge. He will make right. It will go well with those who fear God. But at the moment, that is not always the case. Things are upside down. And if we're honest, it's not just for the assembler. It's for us too. For the life we see, the life we live. A lot of our life is like that. So, how can we affirm faith when the world is upside down? What can we do when we're in the not yet of the wilderness? Well, you don't just put on a fake smile and pretend everything's okay. The assembler doesn't do that. What we do is we join the Jews in the wilderness in their little shelters during the Feast of Booths and read Ecclesiastes with them. So that's what we're going to do. Now, this book is not an easy book to read. That's part of the point, I think. Life is not easy. It's frustrating. It's beyond our grasp many times. So if you felt frustrated in trying to read this book and grasp this book, don't worry. You've just encountered theme number one. Everything is vapor. Even our attempts at trying to grasp this book at times. So So yeah, you might not have understood that intellectually, but emotionally, you feel that. And I can see the reaction sometimes that people get when they read this book. It's, oh, it's frustrating. It brings out a lot in us. And I think that a reaction is important. Some people say, actually, how it reflects and how it affects us sometimes might be more important than even what we're reading at the time. Why is it doing that to us? What's it doing to us? So a few more comments on the identity of the assembler, and then on to everything is vapor. So who is the assembler? This has been a long-standing question. The short answer is, we just don't know. The name of the assembler is never mentioned in the book. That's an important thing just to keep up front. The main options are King Solomon or someone like King Solomon. Solomon-like. Tremper Longman points out that the majority of scholars, including evangelical conservative scholars, do not think this is King Solomon. His name is never mentioned, and there's various things to say why that wouldn't be the case, which I could get into later, but I'm in agreement with that. I don't think this is King Solomon, but I do think at the very least, this is meant to be someone Solomon-like. That we're meant to see this someone Solomon-like, especially in wisdom, in resources, and authority. So the idea is this guy is on par with King Solomon, so listen up. Take him seriously. Don't write him off. Pay attention. And I think this is made explicit at the end of the book by what people perceive to be a narrator. So it looks like a narrator introduces the book, the words of the assembler, and then the words of the assembler come in, and then he makes a little brief appearance at 7 verse 27 with a says the assembler, and then reappears at the end of the book to give sign of an evaluation and a conclusion. So this is something like the book of Job. So, you know, you read the book of Job and you have Job talking and his friends talking, and then God comes in at the end and sets things straight. And this is what he says to the three friends. You have not spoken the truth about me as my servant Job has. So we have here the narrator coming in and giving his evaluation, or hers. We don't know who this person is. And this is what they say. This is from the NIV, but the ESV is pretty similar, and it goes like this. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words in what he wrote, was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads, their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails, given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. So, the assembler here is called, right off the bat, wise. And actually, in if you look closely, it's more like, and this remains, these words remain, because the assembler is wise. That's the actual, more strict Hebrew. But he's called wise here, and it says he imparted knowledge to the people. So knowledge is just another kind of synonym for wisdom. It's in that same category. If you read Proverbs, wisdom and knowledge and insight, they all get interchanged. And then it says, what he wrote was upright and true. And being one of the wise, his words were given by the one shepherd, which most people believe to be God. So this is a way of describing inspiration. We're warned not to add words to this. That's how you talk about inspiration. That's how you talk about the words of God. So now if you take a negative view on this, you have to downplay this evaluation and turn it into, eventually, a critique, a Job-like critique. So that is what Tremper Longman does here. So he says about the very beginning here, about him being called wise and imparting knowledge, he says, this is somewhat complimentary, but very reserved. I don't see that. I don't see that reservation. I don't see the correction. But I wouldn't want to say, if you want to see a counterpoint to what I'm saying tonight, I would highly recommend his book. His commentary is one of the best commentaries I've read on Ecclesiastes, even though I don't agree with his overall take on the assembler. But he goes into great detail of a different view here that I don't have time to get into, but I would highly recommend. I've got the commentary if you want it. But in the end, Bruce Waltke, the Old Testament Bruce Waltke, he's the one who really switched me in my views of Ecclesiastes. He says the majority of conservative scholars agree that the sayings of Kohelet are upright and true, as the narrator claims. That's his understanding of all that. He's got a whole host of scholars he lists who would affirm this. So that's where I go. So I don't see as well any corrections here. I only see praise. So in my opinion, as far as evaluations go, this is pretty good. But maybe you're not convinced. And maybe you think, how could this be? How could this guy be one of the wise? How could his words be upright and true? That's been my question I've lived with for about 4 years, wanting to answer that question. So let's see. Which brings us to everything is vapor. So these are the first words of the assembler and the last words of the assembler. So there's no exit from the mist, from the vapor. It's you're in a sense trapped by it. And it's been translated many different ways. The NIV goes with meaningless. That was the first translation I read. Still did its work on me, even though I think it's the worst one of them all. Vanity has been the most popular. It's had the longest history because that's been the Latin translation, vanitas. And then the newer translations, you're going to see, you see a whole bunch of different choices for this word. Futile, fleeting, enigmatic, absurd, smoke. Robert Alter goes with mere breath. And that's the literal meaning. It's either mere breath, vapor, or a puff of air. That's the literal meaning of the word. And you pronounce it actually Havel. It's spelled H-E-B-E-L. In the original Hebrew, there's no vowels, but Havel is how you say it. I've also heard it said Havel. And listen to these statistics about this word in the book. This is from Bruce Waltke. He says, the word is mentioned 37 times, which happens to be the numerical number of the word. H is 5, B is 2, L is 30. The middle of the book is this pivotal phrase right here. And this too is vapor and hurting the wind. That's the exact middle of the book, so that there are 1,491 words before this and 1,491 words after this phrase. So it's a chiastic structure to like bring your attention to the middle, even though this is also at the ends. And then add to this 111 verses before this verse and 111 verses after, which is three times the numerical value of Havel. So even if only half of that's true, it seems the author is trying to bring our attention to this word. So how we translate it is crucial. It really is. So if we think the assembler is saying everything is meaningless, well, then I would agree that sounds more like a secular existentialist than one of the wise. And I have heard, I've read that when the NIV was originally translating this, back in its first translation, that existentialism was pretty popular at the time. And so to choose meaningless kind of coincided with that and maybe was influencing that. An Old Testament scholar, Ian Proven, who was one of my profs at Regent, he has petitioned the NIV to change it to vapor. But he got a response back to say, this is not practical. We can't just change one word. It's too much work. It's not for existential reasons necessarily, but because Waltke is on, I think he's been on the translation committee for the NIV, and that's what he would vote for too. But vanity, that's had the longest run, but you hear vanity and you hear conceit, arrogance probably. So it's a bit misleading, I think, in that regard. And then when it comes to other possibilities, if you choose one abstract meaning from this word, then you're stuck with that the whole way through. And then you miss out on the other connotations that might be going on in other contexts. Because there's a lot of different connotations to this word. And so if you stick with the one original concrete vapor word, you can hold all those different abstract meanings. So enigmatic and ephemeral, fleeting, these kinds of things, these are the kinds of things that the assembler comes back to again and again. And so if you keep vapor, you can fill that in. And those connotations are just happen to be what vapor does and what it's like. So constantly you're being told things are beyond your grasp. That's like vapor, right? You can't grasp vapor. It's like chasing the wind, herding the wind, shepherding the wind. You can't do it very well. And also, what does vapor do? Eventually, it evaporates. It comes to an end. It dissipates. So vapor is the best choice. Why not go with that? So I think whatever translation you have, if you just put in vapor for whatever word is there, it will really change your reading of the book, I think, in a helpful way. And let the context fill in the meaning for that word. I think that's the point. Now, vapor also has a certain quality to it besides its physical characteristics. It's also frustrating and tragic because of that, because of its nature, because it's fleeting, because it comes to an end, because it's beyond our grasp. It's therefore frustrating and tragic. And that's also in the book. That's also some of the connotations. And the assembler gets frustrated and he gets upset because of this, and he hates things because of this nature. He despairs over this, I think, as he should, as we should. If things are tragic, if things are not as they should be, then then that should cause frustration in us. That should cause anger in us at times. What remains for people from all their toil at which they toil under the sun? That's right at the beginning of the book. This is one of the guiding questions of the book. And I would say one of the, if you're going to switch one more word, this would be the other one. You may mostly see this translated as advantage or profit, which is certainly one of its meanings. But the main meaning is what's left over. So you do a balance sheet and you add up all your assets and liabilities, and what do you have at the end? What's left over? What's your profit? What's your gain? But more than that, that's a bigger category, I think, especially when you contrast it with vapor. So at the end of the day, after all your hard work, after all the dust settles, what's left over? What survives? What remains? That's what's going on. And so if everything is vapor, if everything eventually evaporates, nothing remains, right? That's how these two play together, I think. And not even the greatest, most impressive works you can imagine or you can give yourself to. I think that's one of the main points of what comes in chapter 2. When the assembler makes his own works of greatness. So see what the assembler assembles, and then his conclusion. I made my own works of greatness. I built my own mansions and planted my own vineyards. I made my own gardens and grand enclosures, and I planted fruit trees there of every kind. I made my own pools from which to water the groves of growing trees. I acquired male and female servants. I had homeborn servants as well. Also cattle, oxen, and sheep, more than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I gathered to myself both silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I assembled my own male and female singers, along with untold luxuries that delight the sons and daughters of Adam. I became greater and added more than anyone in Jerusalem before me. Still, my wisdom stayed with me. And whatever my eyes requested, I did not withhold from them. I did not deny my heart any joy, Indeed, my heart rejoiced in all my toil. And this was my portion from all my toil. Then I turned, to all the works my hand had made and the toil I had toiled to do. And look, everything is vapor and hurting the wind. Nothing remains under the sun. So I think just one thing to notice, my wisdom stayed with me. All right, so think Solomon-like here. Solomon had wisdom, but in his story, he eventually departed from it, right? But we're told here, wisdom stayed with the assembler. It says it more than once, not in this passage, but in another one. Still, my wisdom stayed with me. So don't assume that this was just some sinful enterprise he was going after. How sinful, how hedonistic can I be? That is not, you're missing the point, I think. I think there's also some jabs at Solomon, King Solomon, being made through the book. Josh and I were talking about this earlier. And of course, Solomon went too far, and his relationship with women was off. And I think you see some jabs at that throughout this book, which we can't get into right now. But the main point being made here is not that this project was inherently wrong, but that after all was said and done, and he looks at the works of his hands, he realizes he just built a sandcastle. That at best, if you have the money of Bill Gates, or the creativity of a Michelangelo, or both in a King Solomon kind of person, at best, we can build a sandcastle. One day, a wave is going to wash it all away. Everything is vapor. That's the main point. And this is true of every good endeavor, even of every joy and of every person. Everyone and everything has an expiration date. That's what's being a point being made in this book over and over. There is one fate for all, says the assembler. And there's no amount of wisdom that can change that. Not in what you make and not in the end of your life. Cemeteries are full of fools and wise people. And of people who are trying to find a loophole with death. The assembler reminds us in the words of Heidegger, we are beings unto death. Our days are numbered, the assembler says, and lacking. And cannot be counted. And then, while we're alive, things are upside down. Things are enigmatic, beyond our grasp many times. There are accidents all the time. We've heard some pretty bad accidents this past couple weeks. Things you just can't calculate. Realities that just shouldn't be. And the assembler gives you all kinds of examples in his book. Examples of oppression and loneliness and depressed workaholics and corrupt leaders where there should be justice, there's wickedness. And he laments over this. There's a tragic element that runs through everything and everyone. And it's not the way it should be, but it's the way it is. That's the way it is. Everything is vapor and hurting the wind. That's what we have to deal with. And to be wise, you got to deal with things as they are, not as you wish they would be. That's where you start, and that's where he starts. Everything's vapor except God, of course. In this book even, it says that in its own words. And I'll get more into that in the third lecture. Everything is vapor but God and what he says and what he does. There is a kingdom that cannot be shaken. So don't worry. That's still true. There is resurrection. But we aren't there yet. And that won't mean as much to us if we don't first come to terms with everything being vapor. And then it becomes that much more special when you get to it. That's what I have found the more I've read this book. And it's not just the assembler who's saying these kinds of things. So that's where I don't think this book is in contradiction with the rest of Scripture. I don't know if there's anything in this book that contradicts what I've read elsewhere in Scripture. So, for example, Genesis 3. A lot of Ecclesiastes is based out of Genesis 1 through 3 to 4. We'll see. This is what God says to Adam after the fall. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food, until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. So you hear the toil, frustration, dust to dust. These are words and themes, expressions that get repeated and expanded upon in the book of Ecclesiastes. So everything is vapor, hurting the wind, so much can be understood as, what is it like to live in the shadow of the fall? What's it like to be the sons and daughters of Adam? That's a lot of what Ecclesiastes, I think, is showing us. Which is life in the wilderness. You get kicked out of the garden, and what's outside the garden? It's the wilderness. Where things like death happen and murder. Abel is the first mention of physical death in the Bible, the first mention of murder also. And guess what his name is in Hebrew? Vapor. Havel. Everything is Abel. This theme is all through the Psalms, if you read the Psalms carefully, I think. Psalm 39, 4 to 6. Show me, Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting my life is. You have made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but a vapor, a breath. Vapor is the Hebrew. Even those who seem secure. Surely everyone goes around like a mere phantom. In vain they rush about, heaping up wealth without knowing whose it will finally be. A lot of those words are almost exactly what you find in Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes could be seen almost as an answer to that prayer. Or this other prayer, Lord, teach me to number my days that I may gain a heart of wisdom. If you want God to answer that prayer, read Ecclesiastes. And this is not just the Old Testament, this is the New Testament as well. So this is James 4, 13 to 14. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. That could be, again, straight out of Ecclesiastes. Paul goes even further in Romans 8:20. He says the creation was subjected to futility. Sometimes it's translated frustration. And the Greek word for futility, frustration, is the Greek word that translates the Hebrew word for a vapor. So in other words, the creation was subjected to vapor. Everything is vapor. Even Paul is saying it in his own way. Everything but God, right? And his word and his works. We hear him say, heaven and earth will pass away. Vapor. But my words will not pass away. And Jesus, the new assembler, won't let us pass away forever. He loves us and he will resurrect us. He will not let us remain vapor. And so, before his resurrection, yeah, nothing's new. But after his resurrection, everything can become new and beautiful and eternal. So again, I think you're going to know the depths of his redemption, his resurrection, to the depths that you know the fall and the curse and death. And that's what this book helps us do. It helps us see how bad things really are, and then how good the good news really is. And unless everything's vapor, the resurrection, I think, doesn't make much sense. Resurrect what? If everything's eternal. But if it's not, if everything's vapor, then this is good news indeed. And I'm trusting Jesus not just to resurrect my vaporous life, but every good work and every legitimate joy that slipped away. I couldn't hold on to, but he can. It says in Ecclesiastes, the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. Even in Ecclesiastes, it says that. When we're little, we're supposedly we learn something called object permanence. We hear this so that, you know, little babies, they see you leave and then they think you're gone. You disappeared out of existence and then they come back and they're so happy because you came back into existence. And then you realize, oh, they continue even when I don't see them. That's at least the theory. Well, I think when we get older, we learn something called object impermanence. And they don't continue to exist over time. Everything's vapor. And besides preparing us for the resurrection, I think this also helps us in other ways, too. And I think part of the purpose of the book. It helps us to not take ourselves and our work too seriously. To idolize it, right? It frees us from idolatry. Actually, one of the words used for idols is vapor. That's one of the ways they're described. And it's meant to disenchant us from them. So something that's mere vapor, it's not worthy of worship. When you start to see what you do as vapor, you're less tempted to turn it into an idol. And you're more prone to go to the one who's not vapor and who makes things that aren't. And I think vapor can also help us when we don't take ourselves and our work seriously enough. Right? Vapor means you're going to die. Your days are numbered. So get off your butt and do something with your life. That's what vapor should do for you too as well. Your coming death. And I think even as Christians with the hope of resurrection, we have this too. So that they didn't have this hope like we do in the Old Testament. It was hinted at, but it wasn't a full-blown doctrine. We only have so many days to live in this upside-down age to the glory of God. We only have so many days to rejoice in the wilderness before the face of God. So let's take advantage of that. We're never going to have these days again in the new age. So I think that's another way we can reapply the book of Ecclesiastes. All right, we're almost at the end. Back to death. We're part of a culture that lives in denial of death. We really are. We relegate it to hospitals and to morgues. And if somebody starts talking about death, we silence them by calling them morbid. Because we don't know how to deal with it. We don't want to deal with it. I think we don't have enough hope in the resurrection as Christians because of that. But that's a sign of that. But that's why the assembler has to remind us over and over, has to confront us with this, because it's something we push away from our consciousness. To be wise, you got to deal with things as they are in all their tragic sense. And so if we want to live life to the fullest in wisdom, in joy, we got to take everything into account. We got to see, where will our hope go all the way to the deepest, darkest parts? If not, is it real hope? Kind of thing. So the assembler takes us all the way to the end of the road, as far as he can go. That's why he says the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Figure out where you're going. Right? If you could consider what kind of life you want to live, do it while walking in a cemetery. So Uni Lee, who I mentioned earlier, she says the assembler is not calling us to pessimism or to optimism, but to faithful realism. And whether you agree that that's what's happening in this book or not, that is the general call of the Bible. Not to pessimism, not to optimism, but to faithful realism. How can we affirm our faith in the face of death when things are upside down? How can we do that? That's life in the wilderness, where we're at. And so, the assembler takes us all the way down the road. This is going to bring us to our final passage we're going to look at. And as you read Ecclesiastes, what you see him doing is he intensifies each theme. So death gets more and more intense. So does joy, so does the fear of God. And he doesn't cancel out either one of them. Our tendency is to kind of tone down one of these three themes, depending on our personalities. But the assembler never does that. They're all together. And we'll see more of that togetherness tomorrow. But the context of what's coming here is the call to joy is urgent, which is coming tomorrow morning, because of our coming death on the one hand, and interestingly, because of the coming judgment of God on the other. That's the context of this call to joy. That's the context. But this is what's been called the assembler's ode to death. And remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the bad days come, or the years when you say, I will find no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark, and the clouds return after the rain. On that day when the watchmen of the house tremble, and the men of strength are bent, and the grinders cease, because they are few. And those looking through the windows are darkened, and the doors on the streets are closed. When the sound of the mill is low, and one rises up with the sound of a bird, but all the daughters of song are brought low. Indeed, they are afraid of heights, and of terrors on the way, and despise the almond tree, and drag the grasshopper, and broken is the caperberry. As people go to their eternal home, and mourners turn about in the streets, before the silver cord snaps, and the golden bowl breaks, and the pitcher shatters on the well, and the jug smashes in the pit, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the breath returns to God who gave it. Utter vapor, says the assembler. Everything is vapor. It's a moving description of death, of dying and deteriorating and death, of our own death coming, of your death, everyone and everything, in fact. The sun and the moon and the stars are even dying. They're growing dark. The birds and the berries are dying. The golden bowls of human culture are being smashed because our Creator is withdrawing his life breath from everything. What we have here is a cosmic funeral at the end of the book, because everything is vapor. Heaven and earth will pass away. But this ode to death is not meant to depress us. We're meant to lament death, and the assembler does that. Jesus does that at the tomb of his friend. But ultimately, this ode to death is meant to invigorate us, to motivate us to remember our Creator. That's how it starts. Remember your Creator before all this happens. That's what's going on in this passage. And remember your Creator, that is, do His will. And what's His will? In Ecclesiastes, His will is to enjoy the life He has given you. The life He has given you right now from His hand, right here. Right now, even tonight. I was a helper at Dutch Labrie in the Netherlands. And at Dutch Labrie, there's a cemetery across the road. And there's a former worker buried there, Hans Ruckmacher, who I used to listen a ton of his lectures. I used to listen to those back in the day. And he's buried there, and it's very sobering to go over there and see the grave of this guy I've listened to so much of. Well, I used to go there when I would, it was my study time. I would go there to study and to pray, to reflect. And it was sobering, but it was clarifying. It cuts away all the chaff, all the fluff. It helped me to remember death and my Creator and to live life more fully, in fact. I'd give it a try. Thank you for listening. That is all that I have prepared for tonight. But this is the time where we have what's called a question and response, we're calling it now. So we don't always have answers. It's not Q and A. It's Q and R. Sometimes we have answers. Sometimes we don't. But it's a time to interact with things we've brought up, questions you might have, things you disagree with, things you want to add. This is your time. Tom.
Just one quick thing. And the breath returns to God who gave it. Can that also be translated, and the spirit returns to God who gave it?
It's the same Hebrew word. Same Hebrew word is translated as breath, spirit, wind. Exactly. But this is more the life breath, as people talk about it. God breathed life into Adam.
I was going to ask you something a few minutes ago. You spoke about, in the very beginning, that something about coming back to God. Were you suggesting that when you were very young, you were a worshiper of God? And then you left in your teenage years and came back, or you're saying that in effect. Is that correct?
Yeah, I had a sense of God, but I had a sense I'd wandered from Him. And so Ecclesiastes was a coming back in some ways.
Back, yeah.
Yeah, but it was also new for me in many ways too. So a bit of both.
So when you say sometimes have a negative spin on the book, does that negative spin mean that they don't believe that it is divinely inspired?
No, not necessarily. There's negative takes with people who think the Bible is inspired, that Ecclesiastes is inspired, and there's plenty of scholars who have a negative take who don't think it's inspired.
So would it be like that their negative spin, like that the message is from the book is negative? Is that what would it mean?
No, the overall message could still be positive and good. So it could be the assembler is off base, but then by the end, the last section is where things are set straight. So this is the final word, fear God and keep His commandments. That's where the nugget is, the gold, which I still think it's where it all goes to, and that is, I think, in many ways, the crux, where it all takes, you're supposed to go there and end there and see that's the final word. I just think that message just didn't start in those last few sentences. I think that message we'll see on tomorrow afternoon, the fear of God wasn't a new theme, and that it's been expressed all the way through. But people who have a more negative view of the assembler would say, well, they would also say the fear of God was more like a terror for the assembler than a regular fear, the fear of God, a normal fear that the rest of the Bible would talk about. I don't see that, but that's what's argued, and not just from conservative people. Yeah, Nikki?
Could you say a little bit more about the genre of this writing and the extent to which the author of this text would want, or how the author might present this to an audience, and in what spirit should this text be?
Yes. So that's a big discussion. But there is a genre during this time where someone would write and take on the persona of a king to kind of give authority to the text, but it was also understood, well, this person is not necessarily the person they're representing, but they're like them and they're supposed to be taken seriously. But in those genres, the person was kind of amped up, and they were kind of exalted in that genre, so there was a lot made of the person, where it sounds like Ecclesiastes is of that genre, but it's the assembler is not like, wow, look at me, how great I am. So it's kind of a critique of that self-exaltation that the people were making use of in that genre. But that's what a lot of scholars think, is that the author of Ecclesiastes is making use of that. So here I am, and I'm talking in the persona of King Solomon.
So is that why, like, the very first verse, Son of David, he improves on, not the literal, direct Son of David?
Yeah, I mean, Son of David can mean just descendant. So Jesus is the Son of David.
Right.
So it doesn't mean that it has to be King Solomon. But it seems like, you know, it seems pretty obvious that some big hints are being laid down, like this is someone like King Solomon. King in Jerusalem, Son of David. No one was wiser. No one had more resources.
Not a little king, a big king.
A big king. Yeah. But then others say, well, you know, but could it really be Solomon? Because he says, I'm wiser than all the kings before me. And there was like King David, you know. All of David, you know. So there's the third person too, you know, he talks about the king in third person. Why wouldn't you talk in first person if you're referring to yourself? And there's lots of critiques of kings that come later, and leaders. So why would the king do that? Is that answering your question? Is that clear?
You were saying that most scholars see it as somebody like Solomon in terms of his power, his wisdom, and so on. But then, in the biblical story, Solomon started out wise and then really became a fool. And I guess that's one of the views of the book, isn't it? That it's somebody who's fallen away from someone like Solomon, who started out right, but has kind of lost it and still holds on to some of the words. But would that be one of the kind of, quote, negative takes?
That would be, yeah, certainly. Yeah, so it's like you're either taking Solomon as Solomon at the end of his life, where he's gone off,
yeah,
or Solomon as Solomon the Wise, and so you're paying attention to what he's saying. So that's the two, that's what you have to make a decision about.
Yeah.
Is this the Solomon who's wandered and who's lost it, or is he...
55,000 wives and concubines.
Yeah, exactly. So I think he's... This is a critique of Solomon. This isn't about... and at the same time, someone who hasn't necessarily fallen into the traps of Solomon. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I highlighted... It says there, my wisdom stayed with me the whole time when he's doing these big projects. That's when you would think he was off base, because Solomon went off, he oppressed the people. But that kind of oppression is this critique later on. These kings who are eating when they shouldn't be and drinking too much, and the people suffer because of it. He's like, that's bad. And so he's critiquing that. And even the women thing, I mean, we could look more technically at the passages about women. He has a bad rap about women, but unjustified, I think. So there's that one early on that talks about, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow more, concubines, or that's a possible translation, but not a necessary one. So, it's not even the main word for concubines. It's also translated as treasure or musical instruments. So I would say, you know, it's got a variety of, and there's a lot going on, so I wouldn't write his wisdom off because of that one word. And then his other two discussions of women I think are really interesting, and I don't think write him off when it comes to women. In fact, I think you would want to affirm him. But we'll look at that more tomorrow. Or we could talk more about it tonight if we want to.
Just a question. Thank you for this. I was just curious if there's any more. It's just interesting, again, how the book is framed and how much time it must have taken to write, you know, these reflections, to have it all center on that. Are there other sort of structural elements that you sort of give, if you know it, if you can read it in Hebrew, that kind of clue you in onto some of the way you've read it? Or do you know, yeah, like are there other things that are more, that we kind of lose in our reading it in English that be, I don't know. Because that's, I mean, that just shows that it's, this book took a long time.
Oh my goodness.
Together and,
yeah.
And to assemble it, yeah.
Yeah, it's super intricate. There's so many details. A lot of it has to do with refrains and even some themes. So in the first part, you have a lot of chasing the wind language. And then in the second half, you have a lot of who knows. So about knowledge and what we can know and what we can understand and grasp intellectually. So there's that kind of pattern that's going on. But yeah, I told you the vapor theme, so that middle of the book is kind of a pivotal point. Not that much, though, as far as themes. I mean, I'll show you something, actually. I won't show you. I'll just tell you. So I've read a ton on the different ways people imagine the structure to be. And, I mean, it's crazy how, again, so many different interpretations. There's so many different views on what's going on in this book. My favorite one is by Jacques Ellul. And so what he does is he takes three themes. He just takes God, vapor, and wisdom. And he counts maybe like 20 different themes in the book, but he just takes these three and he lists them down and he takes a line to go from one theme to the other. And what you see is this crooked line going back and forth, zigzag, 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 all the way through. And so there's a sense of, you know, he says, what is crooked cannot be straightened. So part of what I think is the structure of Ecclesiastes cannot be straightened. It's intentionally zigzaggy back and forth. So he says, I turned and looked. There's a lot of this. Just like the wind turns. Turning, turning goes the wind. The assembler's turning and turning from thing to thing. But, and yet, I mean, it's really hard. You got to go almost verse by verse. These themes are super intricately woven together. The vapor, the joy, and the fear of God. How they get set up and how they relate to each other. There's 100 details. And that's what Uni Lee does in her book. She takes you through all these things that I would not have noticed, but that obviously people are paying attention to. But the main thing is the narrator kind of brackets the book. The words of Ecclesiastes, and here's the evaluation, and then he jumps in the middle. That's kind of the big bracket. And then all the themes in the middle.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
So it sounds like there's a lot of literary structure and thought. Structure and the themes. How poetic is it in the language compared to like the Psalms or other books of the Bible? And the vocabulary. Is it pretty... Yeah.
It's so funny because people have very different views. There's people, as you can imagine, there's some like, oh man, this language is so rough and tough, and others are like, this is the best poetry ever. And I think the poets get the final say because they see the poetry. And they are the ones who have mostly interacted with this book.
Okay.
And so Jacques Ellul, he thinks it's one big wisdom poem from beginning to end, and that's what I think. And I think the closer you get to the Hebrew, the more poetic it gets. Mm-hmm. And the more literal you get, it's more poetic. Mm-hmm. And usually you think, oh, that's going to be more choppy or not as good. But no, it's better. Mm-hmm. Especially the concrete words. So many of those get put into abstract terms, mm-hmm. and you lose mm-hmm. so much of the richness mm-hmm. of what's going on. Adam.
Yeah, related to that, I mean, in the ESV and probably the NIV as well, like it splits some up into what looks like poetic verses and then other that looks more like prose.
Yeah, and I mean, there's definitely narration, and then there's what seems straight up poetry. So it's hard, but you'll notice they make choices in different ways. So not every translation is agreed on the poetry. And I think what you're noticing with the translations that get more... the newer translations, is that the poetry sections of the Bible are growing. And there's who was it who said that a lot of the poetry in the Bible is locked in prose? And this guy, William Barnstone, who I've read
a lot of his translation. He's a poet and a translator. He's translated a lot of the Bible. He's not a Christian from what I know. But that's his conviction. There's a ton of poetry in the Bible that's locked in prose, and his goal has been to release it. and especially with the sayings of Jesus, he thinks a lot of the teachings of Jesus are straight up Hebrew poetry, and we miss it. So he writes it in poetic form, which makes it such a better read. And so I've done that with the whole book. My whole translation is all in poetic form. There's no prose squareness going on. And so I think it helps too with just getting the sections. When you see some of these space in helpful ways, it really makes for an easier read, a more enjoyable read. Dick?
Yeah, I thank you very much. I've enjoyed this. I come, as I've told you before, with significant confusion about the book. But as I just breezed through it a couple of days ago, knowing this was happening, and one of the few places in the book that I saw the presence of God bringing order and understanding was the verses in chapter 8 that you read here. 8, 12, 13. Though the sinners do evil 100 times, prolong their lives, yet know that it will be well with those who fear God, because they stand in fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, and so on. I guess my struggle is that to me is a glimpse of what you see throughout the rest of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Not just you don't wait to the New Testament to hear that, but you see that in the rest of the Old Testament. God is ordering a moral order. There'll be some sort of judgment reckoning in this life and the next. But that contrasts to me with so much of the rest of this book, where you're said, look at this life, it's vapor. All the things you think that are going to bring fulfillment and order or goodness, there's no justice here. You're not going to see justice here. If you're lucky, you'll have a job that you can do and a wife that you have that will enable you to get some joy out of the dinky things in life. Just getting a salary and eating enough. And you're not. And this is the thing, this is what God has given you. So God wishes you on you this life of just eking out what I would call small meanings in life to make it okay. So God's presence doesn't alleviate vanity in many of these, as it does in chapters 8 and other moments all the way through. So I see a conflict really in where it's not as if the world is empty and awful, but what? You haven't heard, this is life under the sun, and I'll tell you, you haven't heard about God yet. No, God is implicated in the futility and the vapor in the earlier parts of the book. I struggle with the conflict. Is that clear? Am I thinking?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I struggle that with the Bible as a whole. God bringing the curse and death and subjecting creation to futility. I mean, that's like a pretty all-encompassing thing. So I see that. I hear that in the Bible. And then I hear, he's coming to bring order and to bring justice. So I guess I see both of those going on. And the scripture as a whole. And I have the same problem in the bigger picture of the Bible as in Ecclesiastes.
But we're not told it's vanity, and the only joy you can ever find is just trivial joys with, and if you're lucky enough to enjoy your manual labor, in the rest of it, you're told, establish the work of my hands, like in Psalm 90, which spends a lot of time on the futility.
Yeah, well, I guess I wouldn't say, I think part of the point of Ecclesiastes is that those aren't trivial, so it's a very sacramental book, I would say. So it's saying, the fact that you have food on your table and you have meaningful work, these are gifts of God that you're to be enjoyed. They're not to be, trivialized or downplayed just because they're vapor. They're still gifts from God. So I think he's saying on one hand, everything is vapor, and at the other hand, life is a gift. Everything, from God is a gift that you're to receive with joy. So I think, eating and drinking and seeing the good, those are both literal things you're supposed to do and metaphorical for the way you're supposed to enjoy life. So they're not meant to be just relegated to literal eating or just relegated to literal seeing a landscape. But it's meant to be how you look at life. Do you see the good that's all around you? That's what I'm going to get at more tomorrow.
Okay.
But I want to say, and this is Uni Lee, she's brought me to a new level of his view of enjoyment that is much more big and robust than we've heard. And has a moral element to it. To do the good is part of this joy. It's one of the phrases that's linked with rejoice and do the good, which is, the biblical phrase for we're doing what's morally right. So it isn't just like, do whatever makes you happy. But
I'll wait a little more.
Yeah. But yes, it's a perfect setup for tomorrow. Yeah, that's what I hope to show. Your question. We got. Oh yeah, sorry. One.
I was just curious about your thought on the translation of vapor and meaningless. I think you said the NIV starts with that.
Yeah.
Has there been any like repercussion to that? Do people like? Does that become like a stumbling block for people? Like they almost don't want to like read the rest. Or have you heard it? Have you heard of any like repercussions of that translation? Because not to misquote you, I think you said that was like the worst of them, or in your opinion.
That's not just my opinion. Yeah, I mean that's what a lot of people say. But I think it will definitely give you a certain read. If you think the assembler is saying everything's meaningless, that's a really strong statement. I think that's more than what everything is vapor means. It has a different, and so you'll picture him being like, well, he's just given up on life. Nothing means anything. So you can't, if you think everything's meaningless, you can't then turn around and say everything is a gift. Like life is a gift from God if it's vapor, if it's meaningless. But life can be fleeting. It can be transitory. It can be beyond your grasp. And still be a gift. So that's what vapor helps you come to terms with. But it's still a tension. But I think that is the tension of life. You know, life is not something we can hold on to. God has got the main grasp. I mean, that's the image in what we're going to see tomorrow is these things come from the hand of God. He is still the sovereign. How he's doing this and why he brings a good day versus a bad day, that's not up to you to know. He doesn't tell you what's coming in the future. Even though there's promises, it will go well with those who fear God. But his ways are mysterious in a lot of ways, which I think we see Paul says too in different ways in Romans. He's like, look, man, this is what God's up to. I mean, but at the end of the day, man, his ways are still mysterious. We don't have a grasp on them. He is the eternal one. We are mortals. And so he gives us revelation and glimpses, but...
Do you have any idea why the NIV used that word? Is there any thought?
Well, that's what I read. I don't know how true it is, but that back in the first NIV translation, which I think was in the 70s...
Oh, yeah, you did mention that.
That, yeah, the existentialism that was somewhat prevalent at that time. Mm-hmm. And so the assembler sounds like one of the existentialists of our day... And so, of course he's saying meaningless. That's what they're saying. And that's had a lot of repercussions. But it's not without history, too. So the history of vanity, vanitas, that fed into a meaningless translation, too.
Is it vanity?
All right. Oh, wait. We had a question here.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could go Ecclesiastes is unique with the word toil.
Yeah.
Right, and that it talks about this toiling, but almost in a positive light. And is that more sarcasm, or is that like genuine, like taking joy in the toil? Is there some of that? I just wonder if you go kind of more into that idea.
Yeah, toil is. I mean, it's a big word. It probably means more than just work. It means our whole life, but especially work, and especially work after the fall. So like that Genesis passage I quoted, now you're going to toil. So work has thorns and thistles. It's frustrated. It's hard. It's beyond your grasp. But you're still to do it. So if you read the book of Ecclesiastes, he's like, these things are frustrating. They're hard. Your wisdom is limited. But he never says, give up.
He never says, then don't work, don't practice wisdom. He always encourages you. Wisdom is what's promoted, but it's just the limits and the frustrations that you're given. So in a sense, you're given expectations for life, which I think is helpful. And it's poetry, too. So I think that you got to keep that in mind, too. It's meant to be strong, poetic language to help us grapple with these realities.
I was going to say, I thought it was really interesting what you said. Correct me if I misquote you. You said something along the lines of, it is this vaporness that helps us to almost see the value of God. And so in a sense, I think it's very tied together, the meaning we find through these things in life, and how these things in a certain sense point us to a fear of God, in the fact that, you know, it's truly vapor. It's not like, oh, it seems like it's bad, but it's good, or, you know, it seems like we're going to die, but we're not. Like, no, death is a reality. Work is hard. You know, disappointment will happen, and it's not like an escapism.
Yep.
It almost seems like in embracing that, then the value comes too, because if that's really real, then hope can actually, you know, mean something.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep.
I thought that was really interesting.
Exactly.
So I'm really appreciative of this positive, overarching take that you're bringing to the text. And I'm also kind of curious, I think, along the lines of, like, Dick's question, to what extent can some of this poetry jump from the satirical to this sort of, like, already not yet paradigm? Like, is there evidence in the text that some of these verses are supposed to be more, like, jabbing and having a less sort of hopeful outlook, but that there's this constant switching paradigm? So I was wondering if, like, the commentators with a negative view brought elements of that into the text, and just in terms of how it's interpreted in a poem in the Hebrew, is there this jumping back and forth
between
maybe like elements of satire, like after saying, like, oh, this is me, like, this is pointless, this is horrible, but not, that's more of like a metaphorical view, and then are there lines later, or is there any evidence in the Hebrew that there's like a shift in the style, or is it meant to be read as though there's a consistent style all the way? And I'm wondering, like, is this our English Western tendency to want a poem to have a style in its entirety?
Mm. That's a good point. Yeah, I would assume the assembler's doing all kinds of stuff. And irony is something that I think everybody notices throughout the text, no matter what your take. And that he sees the irony in life, kind of like comedians see the irony and incongruencies of life and tell us about them. That's where the eye of the assembler is on. It's all these upside-down things. So that's what I was trying to say. I think generally the assembler is looking at what's upside down, and Proverbs is generally looking at what's right side up, but they both have exceptions, I think, and they both have surprises along the way, and just when you think you've fully figured them out, they play with you a bit. So I don't know if that's answering your question, but I think
yes,
there is. I think the assembler's winking at us at times and smiling, as well as weeping at other times, and playing, being playful, and being utterly serious all the way through. Ben and then Tom. Yep.
So anyway, there's just about the genre of it. It seems like it's definitely wisdom literature, but if there are particular moments of critique in it, directed at King Solomon, it says you imply that. Is there a sense in which it's prophetic, you know, in the way that a lot of the prophetic Old Testament texts are really calling the kings to back to God, offering a very, very, like, blistering critique of the religious establishment or the kings or whatever. Is there an element of that going on, or is it so subtle that it's that's not what's happening.
I think it's more subtle is what I've been seeing, and I've other people see that too, that it's not the prophetic, it's not the prophets.
Yeah.
But it's more subtle, and it goes to more the heart of these things, which is greed. I think the book of Ecclesiastes goes right to greed at a number of places. And I think that, in some ways, is more powerful. It gets kind of to the root of oppression and people amassing all this stuff for themselves. And they don't... who am I doing this for? It's like this guy, he's like, doing all this working without end, and at the end of the day, he's like, who's this for? Who am I working for? And the question is made in such a way, you're like, is this the assembler talking, or him, or am I supposed to be asking this? And you're just suddenly brought in, and you're like, yeah, who am I working for? And what am I doing this for? And that's,
we'll see. If it's too specifically directed at King Solomon, in the way in which we could all, read in a very distant way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and this is just a little bit that I've picked up, and I've read a bit here and there, and actually I was talking with Joshua today. He's heard this from Ellen Davis, who's a professor. She's written a commentary. I haven't read it yet. I don't know if I can get another book on Ecclesiastes. I have enough. But he was reading some stuff from her that was back basically saying this, that Ecclesiastes looks like it's jabbing King Solomon here and there. It's not necessarily the main point of the book, but it's certainly taking advantage of the situation.
The saying, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, fear God and keep his commandments, is that in Ecclesiastes?
That's a bit, putting two together. The assembler ends with saying everything is vapor. And then there's the evaluation of the final section says, the end of the matter, all has been heard, fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole of humanity. Or I think the fullness of humanity is.
You could say in a way that is somehow the whole book.
I think that's where the book's been pointing us to the whole time. I think a lot of people have different people have different understandings of how the book leads us to that final section, but I think everybody agrees that it's always leading us to that final section. So no matter what, I'm with Temper Longman and what he says about the ending there. I don't agree with how he gets there, but, and he wouldn't agree with how I get there, but we both end up in the same spot with fearing God being the best place to be, obeying his commandments, and we'll get into that on the third talk. 1, 2.
Sorry, oh, me?
You first, and okay. Then Hunter, yeah.
I'm wondering then, in light of that and the idea that if we end up at the same place at the end of the book, why does it matter, in your opinion, how you interpret the beginning of it? How does that impact that, right? Like, if we're all ending up at the same spot, you have a strong view, right? And I appreciate it. But yeah. I was wondering, like, why to you does it matter how you get to the end if the end is the same?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm mostly grateful that we all end up in the same place. And generally, we're all before the King, worshiping together. My question is what was intended? Mm-hmm. And is there maybe a bunch of stuff to learn from these 11, 12 chapters that we're missing out on if we think this is just what we're to avoid? So that's my question. If these are words we're supposed to listen to and heed to, and I think that's where I think this book is. We'll see more tomorrow, giving us a more sacramental view of life with God. So it's taking us beyond the festivals even, into living life before God in ordinary life. So I think it's really an in-between book between the Testaments. And kind of laying the groundwork for what's coming with Jesus and the Gospels. So that's why I think it's good and helpful. And it's been used in a lot of ways. I mean, Jerome, his view was, well, the book is basically telling us to love God is to have contempt for the world. And I'm going to say, no, no, no. I don't agree with that. And I don't think, and I'm sure most Christians wouldn't agree with that. But I don't think the assembler is saying that. I don't think he's, just because he's saying everything is vapor, I don't think he means, therefore have contempt for the world. But then he goes on and says, life is a gift from God in all these different ways, which I think we're going to see it's a lot more full than we have realized. I think we hear, let us eat and drink for tomorrow we die, and we think that came from Ecclesiastes, which it didn't. But I think the author must have known about that and is working with that and saying, no, let us eat and drink in the fear of God for tomorrow we die. And that changes everything. That's what I think is being presented in the book. Where?
Yeah, I started reading it this week with this in mind, so I didn't get all the way through, unfortunately. But chapter 2, which you put up, where he talks about him assembling buildings and things, in my translation, it's the same in this one, the ESV, talks about slaves. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house with several generations of slaves. And then it also refers to him having many concubines, I got women, both singers, both men and women, and many concubines. You're saying there's a different word for that or different meaning for that? Oh, musical instruments.
Yeah.
Not concubines or something.
Harem or concubines is definitely a possibility.
Okay.
But it's not the only possibility.
Okay.
So it's not necessary. And some translations don't go with concubines. I think all the main ones do. But I would just say, don't write them off with that one word that's not necessarily concubines.
Okay. What about slave? Is slave and servant the same word?
It could be. It can go either way. And, of course, a king is going to have servants and slaves.
Right.
Or, you know, the line between a servant and a slave, I don't know how much of a line there was back then.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of somewhat of a given. Slavery wasn't, there was no do away with slavery in the Old Testament. Not just in Ecclesiastes, but...
It just comes across, that passage, when I read it, came across much more as somebody just being really self-indulgent. You know, I denied myself no pleasure. I just sort of went after, you know.
Yeah, and that's why I think if there wasn't the... And yet wisdom stayed with me. Mm-hmm. You know, wisdom doesn't let you do anything you want. I mean, within the bounds of wisdom, he didn't deny himself any pleasure. So it's kind of like... It's not do what you like. There's this song, this hip-hop song back when I was in high school called Do What You Like. Does everyone know that? Way back. But it's more do what is wise, fear God, and do what you like. You know, I think that's what we see more and more throughout the book. It will be that will become more prominent. But even there, I hone in on that little wisdom stayed with me. And he said there's another passage, too, that says something very similar. So that's what I look at.
Hunter,
sorry.
So I just wanted to check with some of the meanings of words that you mentioned before. But so the breath that's transitory and somewhat futile is the same word as able.
Yeah.
But the breath of God is attached to Adam, or the same phrase as Adam.
Yes, they're different words, and Robert Alter plays...
I mean, I understand that the breath of God and Adam are one class of words, and are these two different breath concepts attached to the two different people?
I'm not sure if I totally understand. So the breath that God breathes in Adam to make him alive, is that different than vapor?
It's clear to me that you're saying that they're two different words. I just thought it was interesting that the breath that's the breath of God is what is of Adam, and the fleeting breath of the first person who died is referring to Abel. I just wanted to see if that's what you were actually saying was the case.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't understand, but is someone else understanding?
Are you saying, does Adam's breath carry on in a way in the world, and is Abel's breath?
Well, I was just thinking that, well, the two versions of breath, and the two people, and one is the person who died, And and Adam was the first person, the Son of God, who was the breath of God. And I just thought it was a bit of a contrast between the two versions of breath. The transitory one alludes to the person who died.
Mm.
And I just was, you, it's what you said.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I just wanted to make sure I heard it correctly.
Yeah, there's the life breath God gives. And then vapor is a different word. And it's more, yeah, I think it represents more the transitoriness, the everything dissipates, everything dies. So it's meant to have a different connotation, but not totally different. I mean, I think there's a play on words there a bit too. Robert Alter thinks, you know, there's the life breath, and then the vapor, he thinks that's more like expired breath. You know, like the breath that's used up. That's how he understands it. So he has mere breath. So that he says, you know, it'd be nice to have like expired breath, but it's like too wordy.
That would be
Oh, other than Dick.
So my first experience reading Ecclesiastes years ago was sort of, I took it as an affirmation of almost a certain amount of agnosticism being acceptable.
Yeah.
And even affirmed in a way by the vaporous talk.
Yeah.
I'm curious if there's like any other tradition around that discussion, like of Ecclesiastes as an affirmation or in relation to agnosticism, not like as a whole, you know, thought process or worldview, but just in smaller terms, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of interesting phrases. There's phrases that say, like, who knows?
Right.
Nobody knows. This I know. I know this. You know, so there's, it's not one thing for the whole book. So it's not like, he's not totally confident in everything. He doesn't know everything. But he's not agnostic about everything.
Right.
And, but I also think what he's trying to say is, like the knowledge of God and what he's doing, there's a mystery to it. You can't totally figure out. And yet there are things you can figure out and you can receive from him. You can know his hand is giving you good gifts. This comes from the hand of God when he's talking about joy being given to people. So there's certain things he wants to say you can know, it seems. And then other things he wants you to be like, look, beware. You don't, who knows about the breath going up or going down, he says, about with animals, because there was this idea at the time that the spirit of people went up and the spirit of animals went down to the ground. And then so he was like, who knows about this, you know? And it's like, in a sense, like, who can't, yeah, come on, man, like, yeah, it's kind of like people, like, you get into nitty-gritty stuff about the end times, and they want to know exactly what happened and when, and I think he would be opposed to that. He'd say, all right, we know these bigger things, and but don't fret, don't get your underwear tied in a knot over these other things. There's a little too graphic, sorry. Dick.
Yeah, just another one of my issues here, which I'd love to hear your thoughts on, is you can, in some of the verses here, you really can see in a way that to me is unique in the Bible, of what looks like a cyclical view of history.
Yeah.
Which is utterly unlike the whole view of the Bible itself, which is linear. It's an introduction of linear in history in a way that nothing else has brought into world culture of ideas. So one of the distinctive things of the Bible is a resistance to a cyclical view of history,
yeah,
and a linear view of history. He seems to camp out here with a cyclical view. I wonder if that seems to be sort of fundamentally, philosophically, pretty deeply. Those are big ideas.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, the Bible can use an image, and it can be versatile. You can use it in different ways. And I think even the elements of creation can be like that. And I think the original creation description, all of those elements relate to human things. So the sun rising and going, I mean, that's like, the sun also rises. It's right after people come and go. So there's this coming and going that the sun is even representing. It's rising and it's setting. It's people coming into existence and going out of existence. and the wind turning, that represents the assembler. He's turning, at, you know, these key points. It says that, I turned around, it's the same words as the wind. And then the sea not being full, that, you know, that comes right back to the ears and the eyes not being, so the human. So I think what there is not, it's not meant to be necessarily, history's going nowhere, but...
Or just repeating itself.
Just repeating itself. I mean, he does say there's nothing new.
Yeah.
But what's nothing new? Well, nothing's new, everything's still vapor. Everything's still, people are still dying, our work is still evaporating, we're still building sandcastles. So when someone comes along and says, look, I got something new, and it's going to take away all frustration and all death, I think that's what he's getting at. He's not like, oh, there's never a new invention. I mean, he'd been smart enough to know there's always new inventions, but there's always this promise in inventions, I think, and even in our day, oh, this one's going to get rid of all your frustrations. And this one's going to give you some sense of permanence. And he's like, nope, have you forgotten, you know, your memory? You don't have the memory for even what's coming next. And when someone says that, it's always been like this. And there's nothing new because the resurrection hasn't happened. So if the resurrection had happened, that would be something new. And he couldn't say that.
But in Jewish history, you have the Exodus and you have freedom from this tremendous linear thing. But is he saying here is that it's cyclical from the perspective of your observation. The sun keeps coming up, it goes down, it keeps coming up again, goes down. And from the limitation of your perspective, then is that what you think?
I mean, he definitely highlights, yeah, that could be. I mean, I guess I don't fully know, but yeah. It's pretty obvious he makes human connections with each of those images throughout the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does come back to like this cosmic funeral, it seems, at the end. And so there's a purpose of these two cosmic poems at the beginning and the end. And so, in a sense, yeah, heaven and earth will pass away. So I don't think that's necessarily foreign to the Bible. But yeah, I think his point is, there's nothing new. The curse is still with us. Even if God has come in the Exodus, that hasn't taken away the curse, that hasn't taken away brokenness, that hasn't taken away all frustration. And I think a lot of his focus is on the nature of work, on our toil. And I think it's that word work is very prominent throughout the book. And the contrast between our work and the work of God. We'll look at that in the fear of God, but that's his big contrast. Is like, what we make is sandcastles. What God makes is eternal. And so he says that in 3. He makes, what he makes is eternal. Forever. So there's that contrast. So everything human, I think, would might even be more of what would be appropriate to say. When he says everything vapor, he's talking about the human realm, under the sun, what we're doing, what we're involved with, what we come up with, what we struggle with. Mm-hmm. I saw a hand. Ben.
I guess I don't understand the whole, because it seems to me in many other places in the Old Testament there is a linear sense of history, but there's also a cyclical reality. You know, like the king dies and sleeps with his father. It's like, you know, the new king comes up, dies. You know, it's just this relentlessness of birth and death and high hopes and dreams. And, you know, there's, I guess I don't understand how Ecclesiastes would be read as a different view of history as just being cyclical, as much as it is there's an aspect of human existence where we just see the same patterns over and over again. It doesn't mean that history isn't progressing in a linear way. It just means that it's a pretty tight circle as we go forward in terms of life and death.
Yeah. People are still dying. I think that's, you will die.
And why, I remember... One of the Dutch workers years ago talked about a biblical view of history actually is a spiral, not a line, but because of this, the festivals each year was a huge deal was invested in the festivals each year, which brought to memory the long past. But you should think of it, Hebrew history is going like that, rather than in a straight up interrupted line.
Yep.
Or just
or
certainly not just in circles, but to be
Yeah, yep.
And
I think that's very clear too in the book of Judges, for example, where the people are constantly falling back into the same patterns, and then someone will come, and then it'll fall, then they'll come again, and they'll fall, and God is continuing.
Yep. Yeah, and I think, yeah, people point out, like the book of Ecclesiastes doesn't refer to the covenants, but neither does Proverbs, you know, either does the Song of Songs, either does Job, you know. So it's like the wisdom literature is a bit, it's this unique kind of literature that and sometimes focuses on one thing more than another thing. And yet I think Ecclesiastes focuses on Genesis a ton. We'll see some more of that tomorrow. But a lot of it is playing out of that and trying to come to terms with what does it mean to live as the children of Adam. So when I translate that as the sons and daughters of Adam, of course, you know, the Bible was written when gender-inclusive language wasn't around. So the literal term is the sons of Adam. The sons of man, of course, but man in Hebrew is Adam. And I think it's very purposeful. He represents us. He's the one out of whom we're living as far as the consequences of the fall. I think that's really apparent in Ecclesiastes. We're his children. We haven't escaped. We can't escape that reality of Genesis 3. Not yet, I mean, without the Redeemer, but Marty, a little more.
Yeah, it just strikes me again, having seen some of your translations, and I look forward to your final translation, but and some translations that I've read, that there must be, it seems like there's a huge variation of translation possibilities, and that you really come out with a different you come out with a much more positive view or a much more negative view depending on your translation. Is that true? Is that
I think that's as true, especially in this book.
That's what I'm thinking.
If this book is, yeah, it's nuts. You know, they keep saying, this is one of the most difficult passages in the book of Ecclesiastes. And then a chapter later, this is one of the most difficult, how many difficult, most difficult passages. But yeah, there's choices in words. You can go this side or that side. And if you have a certain take, you're of course going to go one way. I don't think that's necessarily true in all of the Bible, but especially in this book.
I'm thinking of this book. Yep. I'm not thinking of the whole scripture. Just
yeah, and if you take a certain view, you're going to, it comes out. And so I definitely am trying to offer a positive possibility to consider. We have maybe one or two more, and we can call it a night. Or maybe call it there. Joshua.
I stepped out for a while to get my kids down. But so you might have said this already, but what is the sort of, what's the relationship between the different wisdom literature books? I mean, they all, like, they kind of come packaged. It's interesting to hear that this is read on the Feast of Booths, you know, that there's this setting for it, almost like a liturgical setting for it that gives it a particular into it, which was super insightful. But yeah, I mean, like, how did rabbis read this? Sort of, how do they read it in relationship to Proverbs or in relationship to Job, or how does that, like, situating it there? I think I'm just curious to hear. So
I wish I would know more about the other books. Yeah, I don't know about the other wisdom books as much. I mean, even us calling them the wisdom books is, they weren't doing that, I don't think, back in the day. I mean, they were definitely clustered together, but they weren't called the wisdom books. They were part of the writings, but that was a bigger category, kind of miscellaneous. More. But they're fun books. I mean, they're books that I think are for our times. Those are the books that, you know, that just help us navigate the complexities of life. That life is, tragic and not straightforward always, and it's confusing. And I find it refreshing, like, for a book to be addressing that in the Bible. And that's what I get there, but I don't know how, I wish I could answer your question.
Because I did a little bit of reading on Jonah recently, and some people are making a big deal that you have to read the Minor Prophets all together, because they were all on one scroll historically. I don't know. All right, I guess. I mean, I didn't follow that advice, but I was just curious if, like, if there was anything like that in relationship. I just don't know that much about the Lutheran literature either, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
So my question was super similar to that, but with your translation that you came to, how much of that was influenced, I mean, you kind of already answered it, but how much of that was influenced by the passages and the books surrounding Ecclesiastes, and also how much of that was influenced by your understanding of New Testament gospel messages? A lot, I would assume.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I certainly want... It's hard. I was writing John Goldengay about a translation. He's an Old Testament professor. He's done a lot of commentaries. I think we might even have some of them. But it's like, you know, what about this translation? And he's like, Dave, I think you're reading your Christian faith into this too much. I was like, okay, you're right, maybe. Maybe, but no. I think that's, you know, something of a temptation, but I don't think it's always unjustified. I think sometimes biblical interpretation can be too, like, just focused on what was available at the time and not a sense of the Spirit. If the Spirit was really inspiring the scriptures, there can be more unity to them, I think, than a lot of sometimes scholarships make room for. Even in evangelical scholarship, I read, sometimes they're like, well, this couldn't be referring to this New Testament kind of thing because that wasn't around yet. I resist that a bit. I want to hear that too, but I also resist that because I think the Spirit can be pointing us to something in the New Testament, maybe before even the authors knew. But mostly I try to say, well, if I'm translating this word, how is it translated in this book? How is it working? And in the rest of the Old Testament especially, you go there first. And then in the broader culture, how is this word used outside of the Hebrews? And then you make your best guess sometimes. I mean, there's a lot in Ecclesiastes that are like, we don't know, man. this is our best shot. I mean...
like dragging a grasshopper, we were saying.
Yeah. Yeah,
no connotations for me.
Yeah. But a lot of the times, you know, they would say, the commentators would be like, this is how we would read it literally, but it couldn't mean this. So we're going to do this. I'm like, no way, that's perfect. I mean, that's like, why would you change that? That's what I feel a lot sometimes is going on. It's like, oh my goodness, this fits perfectly. And sometimes I feel like the scholar's imagination isn't as big as it could be. That I feel like the poets need to be involved more, in my view, maybe working with scholars. To see, because if this is poetry, you need a poet's mind, I think, to kind of see that more. Which I think they have. You read the history of the reception of Ecclesiastes, and the poets just love this book and just draw from it. And yeah.
What's with despising the almond tree?
Well, it's you know, afraid of heights. They can't even get up there. I mean,
an old person who their grinders or their teeth, they don't work. They have few teeth. Is that sort of a metaphor?
That's what some people see, and I think you can see that it fades out at a certain point. You know? So I don't know if that's the whole thing.
Where are we in that?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, the grinding of the teeth, the fear of heights. I mean, that's a big thing when you get older. And
losing your hearing. The sound of the mill is low. Is that?
Yep. And the vision is going, they're trying to look out this window, but it's getting dark. And then the caperberry, they think that could be sexual desire failing. Okay. But more than that, I think it's multi-level, because you have this person who's dying, but then things like with human culture, and then you have the sun and the moon and the stars. Yeah, it's pretty all-encompassing.
Yeah, but I just was wondering about what's so terrible about an almond tree.
Well, I think it's going to tie up. Okay. Like, they're like, shoot, I can't even get up there.
Oh, okay.
I can't even get I'm dragging this grasshopper. That's all I can do.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. I'm dragging it. It's like not even, you know, there's nothing left.
Well, other trees plausible to me. The grasshopper drags itself.
Yep. And it's, yeah, it can go either way. And, you know, it could be either
it's
the
like
birds dragging it.
Like,
or maybe you're, maybe he's seeing himself as a grasshopper dragging himself along.
Yeah. Dragging is either not like it's not vital like that.
It's
right.
Like, oh. Quoted in that Amazon series, The Man in the High Castle. It's very enigmatic how they use it. I was really curious.
Huh.
It's like some sort of prophecy or something. It's weird.
Well, I think we'll finish there. Thank you, everybody.
Dave, what was the mid?